Chapter 6 Zavala had his duffel bag packed and was ready to go when Austin swung by the former library building in Alexandria, Virginia, that his friend had converted to a bachelor pad with a southwestern flair. The two men caught a morning Air Canada flight, and their plane touched down on the tarmac at St. John's, Newfoundland, late in the afternoon after a stop-off in Montreal. A taxi took them to the busy waterfront where the 270-foot-long Leif Erikson was tied up. The 4,600-ton vessel was a brawny ship, less than 5 years old, its hull reinforced for protection against the punishing North Atlantic ice. The captain, a native Newfoundlander named Alfred Daw, knew when their flight was coming in and was waiting on deck in anticipation of their arrival. As the men came up the gangway, he introduced himself and said, "Welcome aboard the Erikson." Austin extended his hand in a bone-crushing grip. "Thanks for having us, Captain Daw. I'm Kurt Austin, and this is my colleague Joe Zavala. We're your new iceberg wranglers." Daw was a compact man in his 50s who liked to brag that he'd been born in a place with the forlorn name of Misery Cove, and that his family was so dumb they still lived there. Schoolboy mischief lurked in his clear blue eyes, and he had a dimpled grin that came easily to his ruddy face. Despite his self-deprecating humor, Daw was an accomplished skipper with years of experience running ships in the cantankerous waters of the Northwest Atlantic. He had often encountered NUMA's distinctive turquoise-hulled research ships and knew that the American agency was the most highly respected ocean exploration and study organization on the globe. When Austin had called and asked to go on an iceberg cruise, the captain had checked with the ship's owners for permission to have guests aboard. He'd gotten a go-ahead and called Austin back with the date for the ship's next departure. Daw had been eager to meet the two men ever since Austin had faxed him a copy of their resumes. Austin had wanted Daw to know that he and Zavala were not landlubber dilettantes who'd need constant watching for fear they'd fall overboard. The captain knew about Austin's master's degree from the University of Washington, his training as an expert diver proficient in a variety of underwater specialties, and his expertise in deep water salvage. Long before former NUMA director James Sandecker had hired Austin away from the CIA, Austin had worked on North Sea oil rigs and with his father's Seattle-based ocean salvage company. Zavala's curriculum vitae said that he was an honors graduate of New York Maritime College, a skilled pilot with hundreds of hours on, above, and under the sea, and a brilliant engineer with expertise in the design and operation of underwater vehicles. Given his guest's impressive academic credentials, the captain was intrigued when he met the NUMA engineers in person. Austin and Zavala came across more like gentlemen swashbucklers than the scientific types he'd expected. Their soft-spoken manner couldn't mask a barnacle-like toughness and a brass ball's brashness that was only partly tempered by their veneer of politeness. His guests were obviously rugged physically. Austin was over 6 feet tall and around 200 pounds, without an ounce of fat on his sturdy frame. With his broad shoulders and powerful build, the brawny man with the mane of prematurely gray, almost white hair looked like a one-man wrecking crew. His chiseled face was deeply tanned from constant outdoor exposure, and the ocean winds and sun had given his skin a metallic burnishing. Laugh wrinkles framed intelligent, coral-hued eyes that calmly gazed out at the world with an expression that suggested nothing they saw would surprise them. Zavala was a few inches shorter. He was flexibly muscular, and he moved with the cat-like lightness of a matador, a holdover from his college days when he had boxed professionally as a middleweight. He had earned his tuition with a devastating right-cross-left hook combination. With his movie star good looks and athletic build, he looked like the male lead in a pirate saga. The captain showed his guests to their small but comfortable cabin. "I hope we haven't crowded anyone out," Austin said as he tossed his duffel onto a bunk. Daw shook his head. We've got a crew of 12 on this cruise, two short of our normal contingent. In that case, we'll be glad to lend a hand, Zavala said. I'm counting on it, gentlemen. Daw conducted a quick stem-to-stern tour of the ship, and then they went up to the bridge, where he gave the order to get underway. The deckhands cast off the mooring lines, and the ship steamed out of St. John's Harbor. After passing between Fort Amherst and Point Spear, the most northeasterly spit of land in North America, the ship headed up along the Newfoundland coast under layers of slag-gray clouds. Once the ship hit the open sea and settled on its course, Daw turned over command to his first mate and spread a satellite photo out on a chart table. The Ericsson delivers food and equipment to the drilling rigs in the warm months. From February to July, we're looking for big stuff floating down from Baffin Bay. He tapped the photo with his forefinger. This is where most of our North Atlantic bergs originate. We got around 100 glaciers in West Greenland that turn out some 90% of the Newfoundland icebergs. How's that translate into the actual number of icebergs? Austin said. I'd guess that about 40,000 medium to large bergs calve in Greenland. Only a fraction of that total comes this far south. Between 400 and 800 make it to Iceberg Alley, the area 48 degrees north latitude off St. John's. They drift for around a year after calving, and then they pass through the Davis Strait into the Labrador Current. Smack into the Great Circle shipping lanes, Austin said. You've been doing your homework, Daw said with a grin. Yep, that's where the trouble starts. You've got a steady flow of ships between Canada, the States, and Europe. The shipping companies want the voyages to be short and economical. The ships pass just south of the boundary of all known ice, which is where the Titanic discovered unknown ice, Austin said. Daw's genial smile dissolved. You think a lot about the Titanic when you're out here. It's a constant reminder that bad seamanship can fetch you a one-way ticket to Davy Jones' locker. The Titanic's grave is near the Grand Banks, where the Labrador Current meets the Gulf Stream. There's a 20-degree water temperature difference that creates fog that's as dense as steel wool. The ocean circulation in the area is pretty complex as well. That must make your job hair-raising at times, Austin observed. I wish it was something I could put in a bottle for bald-headed men. A berg can wander around the ocean like a drunk on his way home from a bender. North Atlantic icebergs are the fastest moving in the world. They'll travel up to 7 knots an hour. Fortunately, we've got a lot of help. The International Ice Patrol makes regular flights. Passing ships keep tabs on icebergs, and the Ericsson works with a fleet of small spotting planes hired by the oil and gas companies. How'd you get into towing? Zavala asked. We tried using water cannon to move bergs. That works with growlers, chunks of ice about the size of a big piano. There isn't a hose big enough to move a 500,000-ton mountain of ice. Towing them to warmer water seems to work the best. How many bergs do you actually lasso? Austin said. Only those that are headed for an oil or gas drilling platform. 2 or 3 dozen. Once a ship hears about a berg, it can adjust its course. A $5 billion world-class rig doesn't have that option. The floating platforms can move, but it takes time. There was a near collision a few years ago. Berg wasn't sighted until it got about 6 miles from the platform. It was too late by then to tow the berg or evacuate the platform. The supply boats pulled it off at the last second. The berg went right over the wellhead. With all the surveillance, I'm surprised the berg got that close, Austin said. As I said, their course can be erratic depending on shape, size, and wind. That one snuck by us. We'll be keeping an eye out for a big lunker that disappeared in the fog after being sighted a few days ago. I've been calling her Moby Berg. Let's hope that we're not Captain Ahab chasing white whales, Austin said. I'd prefer a white whale to an iceberg, Daw said. By the way, did I ever tell you why Newfoundlanders like to drive in winter? Austin and Zavala exchanged blank looks at the odd shift in conversation. The snow fills in the potholes, Daw said. He laughed so hard that tears streamed down his cheeks. The captain had a seemingly endless supply of Newfie jokes that poked fun at his heritage. The jokes continued through dinner. The Leif Erikson's cook served up a meal that would have been worthy of a 5-star diner. As Austin and Zavala dug into rare roast beef, canned green beans, and garlic mashed potatoes, covered with a layer of thick gravy, the captain unleashed his joke repertoire on his captive audience. Austin and Zavala weathered the barrage of marginal humor until they could take it no longer and excused themselves to turn in. When they climbed to the bridge early the next morning, the captain must have felt sorry for them. He dispensed with the jokes and poured them mugs of hot coffee. We're making good time. We've seen a lot of growlers. That's our first bergy bit. Daw pointed to an iceberg floating about a quarter of a mile off the starboard bow. That's bigger than any burger bit I've ever seen, Austin said. It's nothing compared to the stuff we'll see later, the captain said. It isn't considered an iceberg unless it's nearly 20 feet above the water and 50 feet long. Anything smaller is a bergy or growler. Looks like we'll have to learn a whole new vocabulary out here, Zavala commented. Daw nodded in agreement. Welcome to Iceberg Alley, gentlemen.